From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that is time well spent. I'm Michael Crosser. Next to me is Chad Tilburg. And today's title is Building a Better Clock. Hey, Chad.
Hi, Mike. What are we going to talk about today, Mike?
Well, so it's early January for us in 2019. We just celebrated a new year.
We did, indeed. The passage of time.
Passage of time. So we thought, hey, let's talk about time.
Seems timely.
And how to keep track of it.
Okay.
And so we'll do sort of a quick spin through all of this stuff.
Okay.
Hopefully we'll get to some interesting things, all the way up to modern technologies of like atomic clocks and stuff, and how we're learning more about the world and the universe because of better timekeeping.
Okay. Well, that sounds cool.
So originally, timekeeping was really all just astronomical data. So easy ways to keep time would be, oh, the sun is up or the sun is down. Okay, we'll call that a day.
Yeah, so for keeping track of the passage of time, it was mostly just things that were already naturally occurring and occurred at this kind of reliable, repeatable increment, interval.
And so it turns out a lot of different cultures were able to figure out by watching the skies the length of a year. They were actually pretty good at that.
Okay.
Some civilizations tracked other things. For instance, Chinese cultures tracked the passage of Jupiter moving in the sky. It takes about 12 years for Jupiter to get back to where it was originally.
Wait a minute.
Yes, that's why when you go eat at a Chinese restaurant, they have these calendars on the placemat for it.
And there are
12 signs on there.
So that's why there are 12 signs in the Chinese calendar.
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's all based on the passage of Jupiter.
Yeah.
Ah, neat. So those would help you keep track of time in kind of an annual or even longer time period. But what they wouldn't really do for you is keep track of smaller increments of time.
Yeah. And so if you wanted better ways to discuss things than that, you kind of need to improve your technology. It's actually kind of fun. There are some articles on the interwebs that show like some old clocks that have been used, and they got pretty complicated doing all sorts of different things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's really going to be our theme today, is how did technology force us to keep track of better time?
Okay.
And there were sundials. From Egyptians had sundials, and lots of people had those as well to help you keep track during the day. And that would also help you keep track of during the year as well, because the sun in the sky kind of moves up and down, not just east-west, it also moves up and down north-south.
Right. Right now, it's pretty low on the horizon.
For us in the Northern Hemisphere,
in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah. In the Southern Hemisphere, it's pretty high in the sky.
Right. All of our Southern Hemisphere listeners.
G'day, mates.
Don't pander. All right. So what do you know to be some of the necessities that propelled our improvements in timekeeping then?
Well, in 17-something-something, there was a big naval disaster.
Uh-huh.
And that actually prompted the British government to put out a sort of an X Prize for navigation and stuff. Apparently, a number of ships went ashore accidentally on the Isle of Scilly.
Silly naval disaster. Sorry. So, okay, why did they lose track of where they were?
Well, so probably heard that you can navigate by the stars.
Sure.
And that actually works, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, it works pretty well as far as knowing north-south. Your latitude.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Because so the North Star, if you're near the equator, it's just barely above the horizon. Whereas if you were at the geographic North Pole, it's straight up.
Okay.
It's at 90 degrees, basically.
And so if you are navigating somewhere in the North Atlantic, you can find the North Star and you know, okay, that way is north. And if you know that, you know everything else.
Even more than that, you know that that way is north and it's not moving in the sky. So one thing you have to remember is that the Earth is rotating throughout the day. That's what we define our day as. And we're well aware that the sun rises and sets. Every star does that. You know, the moon does that. Everything in the sky does that.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they're moving, but because we're rotating.
Right.
And so everything we see in the sky seems to be rotating around, except the North Star happens to be, just by coincidence, it happens to be located right around the center of where we're rotating.
So this is, you've seen those night pictures before, like a time-lapse picture.
Yeah, those are cool.
So it looks like all the stars make these sort of circular streaks.
Yes.
But then as you get closer and closer to the North Star, the circles are getting smaller and smaller. And then that point right there in the middle,
that's the North Star. Yeah.
Okay. And so how high it is up off the horizon then must tell you something about how far away from the equator you are.
Yeah. So at the equator, it's just right on the horizon.
Uh-huh.
Where we are, we're at about the 45th parallel.
Yes.
And so it's about 45 degrees up in the sky. And so if you're on a ship or something like that, you can measure the angle between the horizon and the North Star, and you can figure out where you are in the northern hemisphere.
Okay, so that's latitude-wise. That's latitude.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, southern hemisphere, I'm actually not sure how they did that, but it was something similar to that.
Okay. But there is something.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's not a single star.
Uh-huh.
But
okay, so that's latitude. What is it that makes longitude so much more difficult to keep track of?
Well, the problem is that we all will eventually see the same thing during the day. If you're in, say, Scotland, and I'm in Oregon.
Okay.
That's about the same latitude.
Uh-huh.
We'll eventually see the same stars.
Yes.
It's just I'd be delayed from seeing it, what, like 8 hours from what you're seeing it.
Okay. You could be 50 miles away. You could be 5,000 miles away.
Right. And so I can't use that as a judge to say like, okay, well, clearly this is what is going on here. Now, one thing that we could do, and this was the solution that they finally came up with, was that, well, what if we kept better clocks so that we would know that if I knew what time it was in Scotland and I could measure at what time I saw the same event, then we could compare those clocks and we could say, okay, well, then I must be this far away from you longitudinally.
Okay.
And so you can measure where you are east-west by doing it that way.
And so as long as you're along the 45th parallel, you're going to see the same night sky at some point.
Yes.
So knowing what time it is in Scotland, that's kind of like your reference point.
Yeah.
And so knowing the time at the reference point and how many hours different you are from that reference point.
Yep.
Then allows you to also translate that into a distance along that great circle of 45.
Yes.
North.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
But to do that, you need to have good, accurate timekeeping. And they didn't have GPS at the time.
And so they ended up grounding all of their ships. Not all of their ships, but they ran a bunch of ships aground.
You know, it was probably a foggy night or something like that, and they didn't know how far east-west they were.
The lighthouse had run out of batteries.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Okay. So that era of exploration and navigation kind of prompted this need for more accurate timepieces that could keep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are we kind of in an era when our technology has spurred an additional advance?
It's funny that I just said GPS a little bit ago, because that is actually requires really good navigation and timekeeping as well.
Okay.
Because there are the fleet of satellites in the night sky and the day sky just up there. And basically, for your GPS to work, you are sending little signals to probably like 3 or 4 of them and measuring how much time elapsed between you sending them a signal and them sending it right back to you, so that you can then say, okay, so I'm this far away from that one. I'm this far away from that one. I must be located right here on the Earth.
It's kind of a triangulating thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, just the internet in general, you need really accurate timekeeping in order to send information.
You got to get that timestamp on those emails.
You got to get the timestamp, but also you've got a bunch of information maybe written out on a page. In order to send, for you to send that to me, it has to go through a thin little line. And so basically this entire page of information has to be sort of like Morse code, sort of a so you have to kind of turn it into a signal of on, off, on, off, on, off.
These are the ones and zeros.
All the ones and zeros.
That I learned about by watching The Matrix.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
But they have to go through one at a time and then be broken back out. And so you need clocks that can synchronize and talk to each other so that the whole internet works, and really so your computer at all works.
And so your computer has to have an understanding of time that matches my computer.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what gets sent to your computer and it's receiving it from my computer, it's going to be all garbled.
Right.
Okay.
And so they do that by sort of talking to each other briefly, and basically they will synchronize. They'll be like, so how fast can you handle? Well, I can only do this. Okay. That's how fast I'll send it out. And then they'll synchronize and talk to each other like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And so if we're going to talk about what is a clock, what's good timekeeping, let's actually kind of go bare bones and back to the beginning. Basically, to have some sort of clock, we need some event that is reproducible. And then whatever that event is allows us to then read out some signal from that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the sun rising and setting is actually a great one. Although, interestingly, we now know that the Earth does not rotate at exactly the same rate all the time. It actually changes a little bit by like a few thousandths per day of a second.
A few thousandth per day.
Yeah.
So it's just slowing down?
We have like, for instance, the moon is orbiting around us, and so it's kind of tugging on us and doing different things. And,
oh, I see.
So I don't think it's all in one direction all the time.
Okay.
But every once in a while, there has to be a leap second every once in a while just to resynchronize so that we agree with what the Earth is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could imagine billions of years from now, then all of a sudden we'd be off by,
oh my God,
you know, or something.
Yeah. It'd be so hard to set my DVR to record
anything
in that kind of an environment. Could you imagine?
Yeah. So,
okay, so these other ways of keeping time that were more of like a stopwatch, so kind of like an hourglass, for example, that wouldn't tell you time of day, but it could tell you a regular amount of elapsed time.
Yeah.
Right? And everybody's familiar with the idea of an hourglass. As you mentioned a little bit ago, it's got this repeatable process. The same thing happens time after time. And so
in this case, you're saying sand is falling through a tiny little hole.
Right. And to the few seconds kind of level of accuracy.
Yeah.
And there were other clocks that worked kind of on the same principle that used water, like a vessel of water, and the amount of time that it would take for this amount of water to drain out of that vessel would be another way.
There were some ways with burning candles.
So like you've got a little candle standing there and some regular increments marked off behind the candle. And you can be doing whatever this activity is as the candle starts here. And once it burns down to there, you're done.
Yes.
So these aren't good for what time of day it is, but these are good for elapsed time.
If you were regular about it, for instance, you could imagine an hourglass, you know, a cascade of these where you've got one hourglass and as soon as it's done, you can have someone hired there just to knock over the next one.
Yeah.
So you could kind of alternate back and forth between them.
Yeah.
So you could do that. Okay.
But none, and then there's what, the pendulum?
So then the pendulum. Yeah, and pendulum clocks really became popular. Galileo was actually credited for doing a lot of the early work on pendula. Galileo was actually hired by the Vatican to figure out how a trebuchet worked, because the Moors, as they called them at the time, had trebuchets. That's what he was hired for.
Huh.
And instead, he sat through church services and looked at the swinging of all the lamps and was like, hey. So he never really did what the Vatican wanted him to do, ever. Ever.
Oh my God, classic. So like writing a grant for one thing and then doing something else has a long history.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, so then famous scientist named Huygens, Christian Huygens, actually was able to make a clock. This would be like late 1670s or something like that. That was accurate to better than like 10 seconds a day or something like that.
That's pretty good.
So a pendulum clock that with that would be, I don't know if you've seen like a grandfather clock before, but it's basically this long arm, and at the very bottom of it, there's a heavy object that is swung back and forth.
Yes.
And the placement of that object is how you can dictate how fast it swings back and forth.
So how high or low on the arm it is?
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So if you move the heavy thing up a little bit, it'll actually swing a little bit faster. And if you move it down a little bit, it'll swing a little bit slower. So you can really fine-tune exactly how often it clicks. And so you can get it to be very, very accurate just by fine-tuning exactly where the weight is. And they got even more complicated. They started making springs involved and doing different things so that you could have things that didn't matter so much with the vibrations. And they weren't as accurate as the best pendulum clocks, but they still worked out well.
And are you also going to explain what it is that the pendulum is actually doing? Because I know that if I start a pendulum going, that's just a weight hanging from a string, and I just let it go, it'll go for a little bit, but each swing is a little bit lower until it comes to rest.
Sure.
So what is it that keeps a grandfather clock pendulum going?
Oh, they wind down.
And then, really?
Yeah.
So you have to continuously go and re-energize the pendulum?
Yep.
How often?
So my family had one growing up that actually my grandfather built. So I'm going to call it a grandfather clock because it was my grandfather's clock.
Okay.
And it had some sort of a chain in the back that every once in a while you had to... And there was a weight on the end of that, and it would gradually tick down. So presumably, that was helping to give it a push every once in a while. But you did have to, like, recharge it. You did have to keep it going. But there was a problem with these clocks, which was that there wasn't great temperature control at the time. I mean, it works great for just doing stuff. But if you're, for instance, wanting to navigate, you really want to be more accurate, even though you're in the hull of a ship that may be very, very hot one day and then get very cold at night and storm may blow through and, you know, who knows what the temperature is doing. And the problem is that the pendulum is that if your arm gets longer, then now your second is different. And so that was a real issue for a long time.
Okay.
And people couldn't, for instance, take a good clock onto a ship and keep accurate timing of things.
Would the rocking of the ship take out the sway of the pendulum, though, too?
It's possible. I tried to read up on what was the biggest effect, and I'm not sure.
Okay. Because there are also spring clocks.
Yeah.
And I could also see how a spring clock, a coiled spring, would not be affected by the rocking of the ship,
right,
but certainly would be affected by those temperature issues that you just mentioned. Is that
true? Yeah, because the spring itself would change length as you get hotter or colder and stuff as well. So temperature was a big issue there. And so this is why, for instance, with the tragedy at the Isle of Scilly, that they didn't have ways to measure time accurately enough. But because of that travesty, the British government put out this prize to anyone who could build a better clock that could be traveled around. And the guy who won that, his name was John Harrison. He was an amateur watchmaker, basically. And it took him decades to really nail this down. So this prize was out there for a long, long time. And it was like 50 years before he actually claimed the prize for it. But he won the prize because he figured out how to reduce the friction in the gears. He figured out how to get certain materials next to each other so that if they did expand and contract due to temperature, that they would sort of offset each other a little bit and it wouldn't throw off the time too much. So anyway, much later than that, we got better at keeping time. And probably the most common way to use timekeeping now, whether it's in your computer or your watch or your phone or anything like that, is to use a quartz crystal.
That sounds sort of mystical.
Yes. Every crystal has certain vibrational energies
oh,
to
no.
it. No. So quartz has a really cool property to it, which is that it is, I'll say the word, is piezoelectric.
Yeah, don't insult me by explaining what that means. We all know.
Oh, good. Okay. So good. Anyway, and because with that, then you can get an electrical signal from it.
So this is why all of our watches, or many of our watches, say quartz on them.
Yes.
Okay. So what piezo...
Piezoelectric.
Piezoelectric.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what that means is that basically, if you squeeze it, it puts out an electric voltage. And if you apply a voltage, you can actually change the length of it, how big it is.
Mm. Okay. So what is it about the lattice structure of this quartz crystal?
No idea.
Okay. But it's just a property of it that...
And it's a very cool thing that you can... If you apply a voltage to it, it will get bigger in one direction. And if you take the voltage off, compress it back. Yeah.
Okay. And so if you kick it with a voltage at kind of a regular interval?
Yeah. So if you give it a little zap, though, it'll grow and then it'll kind of vibrate back. It'll kind of, like most things, you know, it's sort of a swinging door. Like you open the door and then it'll kind of...
Oh, like one of those kitchen doors in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
And it will do that at a very specific frequency. Kind of like the pendulum. Like if you can change the shape of the crystal, if you do different things to it, you can get it to vibrate at a very specific frequency that it does.
Okay. And so it's the quartz is kind of bouncing there.
Yeah.
And as with a pendulum, that will get damped out to nothing eventually?
Eventually, yeah.
Okay. And then another kick from an electrical source will reestablish that vibration?
Exactly, yeah.
That's neat and everything, but what does that have to do with timekeeping?
Well, what's cool about that is that depending on the shape, depending on the crystal structure itself, will determine what we would call the resonant frequency of that is.
Okay.
And it turns out this particular material, if I give it a zap, I can make it grow and then it'll do that. But because it's oscillating back and forth, it's also putting out its own electrical signal. So we can count that. We can be like, oh, pulse, 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 good. And count, you know, some huge number of those and say, that's 1 second right there.
So each time it compresses back, it goes back even more compressed than its resting state.
Yeah.
And it's during that part of the cycle that it's actually sending out a little pulse of its own electricity. Is that
exactly?
Oh, got it. Okay. So that's what creates the pulsing electrical signal coming from the quartz itself.
Yes.
Oh. So does the size or temperature or shape or anything of the quartz crystal make a difference?
Yes. If I just gave you a quartz, you'd have to calibrate it yourself and figure out stuff. But you can grow quartz. You can also put it into certain shapes and so forth to get it to vibrate at certain rates. But as you said, with temperature, that actually causes a problem too, because that also affects how quickly this will oscillate back and forth. Another thing that affects its frequency is when it's getting ready to stop, it actually has a different frequency than when it's going really normally. You can kind of imagine this with a door like swinging back and forth, like maybe.
Oh yeah.
And so these quartz crystals, right at the end when they're about to stop, then they change their frequency a little bit. And so what your watch is actually spending a lot of its energy doing is it's regularly giving a little pulse to the quartz crystal to get it to keep going all the time so it doesn't shut down and stop. And that's how you can try to keep accurate time per day. But that's an issue, is that the rate at which it slows down is not necessarily consistent, depending on the temperature, depending on all sorts of different factors. It could get off a little bit. With your own personal watch, we don't care so much. That's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. But if you want accurate GPS signals, if you want all that stuff, you need to have better than that.
These microseconds actually matter.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And so that's where, in recent years, you've probably heard of something called an atomic clock.
I have heard of an atomic clock, and I think I am laboring under a misapprehension of how they work.
Okay. What do you think of when you think of an atomic clock?
Well, okay. So what I think about radioactive decay of an atom, some elements are radioactive, and they're kicking off certain particles at an average relative pace. Because, yeah, I guess I was always thinking that an atomic clock was based on spitting out alpha particles or something.
Right.
But
that is not the case.
That is not the case.
No.
Oh, I'm in danger of learning something.
That is always an issue with this podcast.
Entirely new. Yeah. Okay.
It's always a concern. So I agree. It's unfortunate that it's called atomic clock because that gets in everybody's mind radioactive stuff.
And yeah.
It makes you think like, well, should I wear a watch that has radioactive stuff in it?
Your watch just beeped.
Total side story.
Yes.
When we had daylight savings recently, This is a fairly new watch for me. And I had to figure out how to change the time to jump 1 hour up. And I accidentally turned on the hour beeping. And I have not been able to figure out how to turn that back off.
Does it beep through the night too?
It does.
Oh.
So I keep it in the other room now.
Oh, man.
It's annoying. So I may have to get a new watch and just throw this one away. Speaking of timekeeping.
Yes. Okay, so correct my misunderstanding of how atomic clocks work.
So if you buy an atomic clock, that clock itself is not actually the atomic clock. The atomic clock is actually a complicated experiment. And so we have, in the United States, we have NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. When you buy an atomic clock, it's sending a question every once in a while to the real atomic clock and saying, what time is it now? Good. Got it.
Okay.
Yeah. So a real atomic clock is in Colorado at NIST. And what they do is they have a quartz crystal that they're keeping time with. But the problem with the quartz crystal, as we said, is that when it's getting slower, it will change the frequency a little bit. And so you could just every once in a while just be like, zip, just zap it every once in a while just to keep it going all the time. Kind of like a hamster in a wheel. Just, you know, when it starts slowing down, it's tired, then you just zap it again and just get it to keep running. And so what you want is some sort of a feedback mechanism to be like, okay, so you are slowing down. Let's zap you again right now. Because, you know, maybe at a different temperature, it will slow down at a different rate. And so you may not zap it at just the right moment. But if you can recognize that, then you give it another little zap, then it'll keep better time that way. In order to do that, they need a feedback with some sort of atom, some sort of element. And what they are using right now is an element called cesium, which is on the periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about how each atom has a very specific fingerprint of light that it interacts with.
Yeah.
That like hydrogen will react with the pink light. How?
If it's electrified, you mean?
So if you just get an atom excited, it will give off very specific colors of light.
Got it.
It will also absorb those very specific colors of light and not other colors. And this is what cesium does. For cesium, this is in the microwave region of light.
So it's not visible to our eyes.
Correct.
But it's still part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Exactly.
Okay.
So what they have is basically cesium gas shooting across the room. And what they will do is have a quartz crystal. You know, I could hook that up to an antenna and send out microwaves, which is what radio stations do all the time.
Mm.
And so we could set this up so that we could have a quartz crystal that is making microwave radiation onto the cesium atoms. Now, if it is oscillating at just the right frequency, it will excite the cesium atoms. So I can say, oh, good, these are excited. It's vibrating like it's supposed to be doing. We're all good.
Okay.
But if the quartz then starts getting off time a little bit, if it starts slowing down, let's say, now it's sending out a different frequency of microwave radiation.
And then the cesium, it's no longer absorbed by the cesium?
Exactly.
And so then, let me guess, that is when the system is told to give the quartz another little zap?
Exactly.
Okay. So in this case, in the atomic clock part of this, there's still quartz involved, but the atomic part is just because a pure atom absorbs electromagnetic energy at a very precise wavelength.
Exactly.
It's like the fine tuner or something.
Right.
Okay.
And in fact, now the second is actually defined by that frequency of cesium. And so that frequency of cesium, actually, let's get this just on the record, that the second is now defined as 9,192,631,770 oscillations of cesium.
Wow. So every second oscillates 9 billion times.
Yep.
Wow. And that, because this is some sort of atomic property, is it unaffected by temperature?
Correct.
Okay.
And so now this is independent of temperature. We can just, and it creates this nice feedback loop for the quartz crystal, and it lets things be very, very accurate.
Okay. So that is happening in Colorado.
Yes.
And a signal is being sent out from there, what, to the rest of the world? Or are there several atomic clocks around the world sort of that are regionally for those regions? Or is there one atomic clock in the world that then tunes everything else?
I believe, so most countries have their own standards in their government.
Oh, okay.
Sort of like NIST. I don't know what they're called the rest of the world, but
okay,
there are, you know, things like NIST all over the world. You know, there's one in Paris. You know what? We should actually have like a series of podcasts about units of measurement and stuff like that.
That's
so like
here,
we're talking about seconds and clocks and things like that.
Yeah.
In Paris, there's also, that's where it used to be defined what a kilogram was.
Uh-huh.
They had a hunk of metal there and they said, this is a kilogram. And people would have to take their own hunks of metal to Paris to be like, I think this is a kilogram. And they'd be like, nope, sorry.
Can I add to that idea?
I think
there should be a traveling podcast and we should go to these places.
Agreed.
Okay, good. Okay, so one of the reasons you got all excited about this is because you mentioned something about NIST changing the element involved in the atomic clock. Is that?
Yeah, well, so what's really cool about it is that we are now accurate enough. We know the Earth is actually changing its rotation ever so slightly. By thousandths of a second per day.
And we know that it's the Earth rotation that is changing, and it's not just a little bit of, inaccuracy in the clock?
Correct. We now know that our clocks are so accurate that we can detect those slight and subtle changes. I got interested in this because NIST is now working with another element, ytterbium, which is apparently going to allow them to be even more accurate than they are right now with the cesium. But presumably, with this new form of clock, it is even more accurate, by orders of magnitude more accurate than the cesium itself.
So what is this going to allow us to do even better? Is this going to affect computing in some way? Or,
well, what's interesting about this would be that depending on where you are on the Earth, the gravity would be slightly different. And what's interesting about that is that general relativity tells us that gravity actually affects time itself. And so you could actually measure how time is slightly different if you're standing on granite versus if you're standing on sand or something.
Or if you're in like some sort of meeting and it's just dragging on forever.
And you're like, oh.
Yeah. Oh, yep. Sure enough.
Yeah. Or school.
Time is running slower here.
Yeah. All of my classes, somehow it's in a gravity bubble. It's tragic, but yeah. So there are some exciting things that by getting more and more accurate ways to measure time, you can actually learn more about the universe.
Okay.
Which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Does, I would assume that, so navigation kind of initially prompted this big increase in the
accuracy
of timekeeping. And now GPS also kind of helped spur this big increase in, more modern increase in accuracy of timekeeping. And if we're thinking about like traveling in space, like to other planets and elsewhere in the solar system, and if now we're dealing with the effect of probably having to deal with the effect of gravity on the pace that time passes, I mean, I guess I'm looking for a navigational theme here.
Well, we've been able to actually measure that before.
Uh-huh.
We've had a satellite go behind the sun before, and the satellite was sending us regular pulses, just like any computer would.
Uh-huh.
And as it neared the sun, the signals we were getting actually changed the rate a little bit. And that was due to the gravity of the sun.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the sun is much more massive than the Earth, so it's a bigger effect right near the sun.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, we've been able to measure that before, but it's a very, very subtle effect, particularly here on Earth.
Yeah. And I guess that's not so much a function of timekeeping, but a function of time itself being different near massive objects.
Yeah, exactly.
But in order to be able to detect that, you would need accurate timekeeping.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I hope this time has been well spent.
Yeah.
I hope you've had the time of your life.
Good times.
This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rudy Ortega wrote our theme music. If you like the show, go on to Facebook and like our page as well. We will put up content that we find interesting. If you have a question for a future episode, or if you would just like clarification on anything from this episode, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. Also, subscribe to this podcast and it will download into your feed automatically as soon as the episode becomes available. While there, leave a comment and a rating. That'll help other people find our podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.